From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 316 with guest Mark Manassi, recorded Thursday, May 2nd, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and you're listening to Run As Radio. I am out in the field. I'm in San Francisco at Tech Day San Francisco, and I ran across Mr. Manassi. Already done your talk for the day?
This isn't a field, you lying sack of whatever. Oh, we're surrounded by concrete.
I guess we are, yeah. We're in the Microsoft office, but I'm not in my little studio at home, and you're not in your place in Virginia. We're actually together, which is always trouble.
You know, it's astounding that we haven't worked out yet. Why is it that you're massively wired, I'm massively wired, and whenever we do this thing over the phone, we're doing it over the freaking phone? I mean, why is there not an easy, good Skype? If there were good Skype.
You hit it. I do use Skype some of the time.
But you can tell on those programs.
Yeah. Well, and the whole thing is when Skype is good, it's better than telephone.
Oh, gotcha.
And when Skype is bad, it's absolutely horrible.
Well, I've got Vonage, so I mean,
that can so you know all about VoIP pain.
That sort of thing will happen sometimes.
Exactly. And so I sort of go back, Skype is a love-hate thing. But you know that, and for better or worse, good old-fashioned telephone just works.
I don't have one of those anymore.
You have your Vonage thing.
I have no wired phones. I'm about to get rid of the landlines in the houses. I don't know that I...
Yeah, you're crossing over that line. I've kept mine, but I think I'm the only one. Yeah.
I'm telling you, I'm just so close, you know. And cell service has gotten much better. I mean, despite the fact that I have AT&T, which is... You know,
the only thing wrong with AT&T is they made that deal with the iPhone. It's actually a good network. It just got killed by a product.
It's not a good network. It's a good network if you live near I-95, if you live a major thruway, right. A big city, you're golden. Let's stick it out in the middle of Calgary or the middle of Manitoba or something when I'm fairly sure you will not be getting too much of that, much connectivity.
There's a whole lot of Canada without signal, that's for sure.
Well, I'll be finding out about that. Coast to coast, not coast to coast, but part of it. I'll be seeing some of Canada, some pieces I've been wanting to for a while.
Cool.
So listen, we're going to do a run as this time, and I think we should do something a little bit different. Let's touch on a little bit of tech, but I'm going to talk about some other tech because you may not know this about me, but I read lots of science magazines. Hmm. And I'm just fascinated by that stuff. And so I got some news items.
Okay.
That I think, I'll try to keep it short as possible. So, we're doing this in, what month is this? May? This is May 2013.
Yep.
And so anybody listening now, when I think science news, they might have heard about those three near Earths that they found that, Kepler 23, whatever the heck it is. Yeah, exactly. I got a better story for you.
Okay.
Because the interesting super Earth, as I recall, is, 40, 50, 60 light years away, something along those lines. And if my government gets off their ass and actually puts the Webb telescope up in the sky, which will be fantastic, we'll apparently be able to image those suckers and really see blue-green planets. Can you imagine? What would that mean if we had an image of a blue-green planet, first of all? How much would that change the way we all think? That would be A. But B would be, what if we could image the night side and there were little lights?
Yeah, would that be something?
You think it would be a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think there's a couple other pieces of this. Even before you could actually get a photograph of it, it's can you get spectral analysis?
Sure.
What if you can show...
If there's industrial waste in the...
Exactly.
Exactly, precisely.
So, I mean, just a nitrox atmosphere, which would mean that there's plant life, would be really interesting all by itself.
Well,
much less petrochemical residues.
No question that an atmosphere like ours would be interesting because we had to have an ecological crisis for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the waste product. All this oxygen is the waste product of the blue-green algae, and they killed themselves, essentially. They polluted themselves to death.
Mm-hmm.
But still, 40 lights is a long way. 60 lights is a long, long way away. Well, one of the other guys, this is a different outfit. These guys are doing some sort of optical thing. I can't tell you which one it was. I don't know. It's not Hubble doing this or anything else. It's just a fair-sized reflector somewhere.
Right.
And they said, you know, there's a lot of stars nearby. When we say the nearest star other than our sun is Centauri, which is, 4.5 lights away or
something like that.
You know, there's ones that are closer. They're just little red dwarfs. And most astronomers will tell you that red dwarfs are they're the nuisance in the sky because it's like you're trying to image stuff. And what's that? Oh, it's a red dwarf. You know? And they're everywhere. You know? And so what these guys did was they said, you know, let's image all the red dwarfs like within 30 lights at us.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea is that they're dim enough that if they've got a planet across them, it's fairly easy to see to occult it. So this whole, this idea is not, we're not looking for the star wobble. We're looking for the occultation.
Right.
Okay. But the problem is this. That means the plane of their ecliptic
right.
has to go straight through our solar system and straight to the Earth, which is a very low probability.
Right.
And they're thinking, we'll look at this for years, whatever. 4 months into it, they find an Earth-sized planet in the Goldilocks zone
right.
around a red dwarf, 17-day year, and it's 14 light years away.
Hmm.
Now stop and think about this. The probability that we find something that close, now imagine if we could see the ecliptics.
Yeah.
It's not unreasonable to say that there is probably an Earth-like planet in the Goldilocks zone within 4 or 5 light years.
Sure. And it gets back to the Drake's equation. It just says, you know what? There's a, now, bit by bit, we're knocking out these things. There are a lot of planets. A lot.
But when Frank did that, he didn't even know for sure there were planets in our solar systems, you know? So, I mean, and think about it. If there's an Earth-like planet or a planet in the Goldilocks zone,
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 light years away, NASA's got, what is the New Horizons, the ion engine thing, which has been running for ages.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, that thing can get up to a tenth of a light speed.
Yep.
I mean, imagine the idea of actually getting a probe, take some pictures, it gets there 40 years from now. The pictures take 4 years to get back. I don't know if you and I will still be around.
Right.
But, you know, it would be.
Clearly we can build spacecraft that lasts that long. Voyager's still running. You know, like, we can do this.
Just left the solar system.
They're still arguing if it's actually right? It's sort of in the heliopause, but it's making new science. It's in a space nobody's ever been in before, and we don't actually know what it is, which I love.
One has gone before.
But, you know, it sure turns all that science fiction on its head when we were supposed to fly spacecraft into solar systems and scan the planets. You know, that long before we'll ever do that, we'll have every planet scanned already.
Well, maybe there are large classes of stars we're not going to get near. And again, look, the fact that we've got, imagine this, imagine being on a planet as warm as Earth and whatever else,
mm-hmm.
and circling a red dwarf, for God's sakes. I mean.
Well, how could it be as warm as Earth with only a red dwarf?
Oh, simple. I mean, red dwarfs can be thousands of degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, you're
just going to have to be much closer to it.
We found a cool one a year and a half ago. It's only 315 degrees Fahrenheit. You can't even cook bread in it.
Won't do a good chicken.
Precisely. You know, good for sushi, but you know. So the idea is close enough because the year is only 17 days.
Right.
Which is amazing.
Whizzing
stuff.
Fast.
Amazing stuff. I love that. I have another little fact that I came across. I've been doing a great course with the teaching company called Rise of Humans.
Okay.
And it's an anthropology class. And I love doing science classes with those guys because I think I know this stuff because I took it 30 years ago. And who knew? People learn stuff. They finally got, just a few years ago, they finally found a Neanderthal bone with enough DNA to sequence. And the funny thing was we have tons and tons and tons of Neanderthal skeletons. But for some reason, it's the bad location. There's no DNA. They find this one little leg bone in some place that somebody actually thought was an ape leg bone. Figured out it's Neanderthal. There was enough stuff in there it's a finger bone, to sequence the DNA. And we know all kinds of stuff. This is fascinating. Because what's the question? Are the Neanderthals our cousins? Are
right.
we descended from them? Are they descended from us? Well, now, of course, nobody knows for sure.
No.
But the thought is that our common ancestor goes back a little ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, quite some ways, back probably to Heidelbergensis, which is also interesting because they're looking at the inside of the skull of Heidelbergensis. And if I understood this right, it may have had a Broca's region, which means there's a decent chance that, you know, Neanderthals aren't the first ones speaking. We're not the first ones
right.
speaking. You go back a couple of ranges, which pretty amazing, which means there's a chance that Neanderthals could talk. We also have a Neanderthal burial area where there's a whole pile of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And someone's put flowers in this hole.
Yes. Well, that was the Jane Olds inspiration around the Clan of the Cave Bear was not only the flowers, but also the body of someone who's clearly was deformed and could not have been a productive member of society, but had lived to an old age. Like, it just said so much about that society.
And we recently, this is in South Africa, about a year ago, they discovered a workshop where people were making paint that was 100,000 years old.
Wow.
The general idea has been that consciousness was about 60,000 years ago. Hey, if you're painting things and you're taking the time to make paint, I'm going to say you're in the consciousness area. And by the way, 100,000 years ago, you're not Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
You may be some of the earliest sapiens, but more than likely you're Homo sapiens rather than sapiens sapiens.
Yes.
We also know that Homo erectus has gone all over the place. And then parts of Israel, there were places where Neanderthals, erectus, and sapiens were living together for about 30,000 years.
Yeah, you wonder what that was like.
Well, here's where it gets even weirder. This is the absolute weirdest part. So they look at the DNA, and they find that if we looked at your DNA or my DNA, about 3% of our DNA has Neanderthal chunks in it.
Right.
Well, no, wait. I said they're not descended from us.
No.
So how did we get that? Wait, the plot thickens. If you get an Asian person, sequence their DNA, 3% Neanderthal. You get someone from South America, North America, 3% DNA. If you get someone whose family has lived in Africa forever, 0%. What that means is, clearly we were already a species.
Yep.
We move out. Neanderthals are there. Wait a minute. You're telling me that we're
crossbreeding. You did
what? Yeah, exactly.
You
did what?
You did what?
And you lived to have kids. I mean, imagine if we were a tribe somewhere and one of the ladies started hanging with chimps. We'd be like, oh, that's just not right. that DNA would not be perpetuated. But there's certain stuff. Like, for example, you take your finger and run it around your tooth this way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a channel that many of us have. That's a Neanderthal
trait
aspect that you pretty much only find among Europeans.
Interesting.
Yeah, so there's much more to be learned there. They even found somebody who's even a little closer. If I remember, I'm going to get the name wrong, but like it's a Dinson man, something like this, out of the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
All they had was a finger bone. But now that they found this thing, this is another distinct species, and lots of the DNA is found among Asians. So some very, very unhappier news, though. I was just in Seattle, which is, of course, the home of Starbucks.
Yes.
And there's some news about bees and caffeine. Did you hear this one?
No.
So there are some flowers that introduce caffeine into their nectar.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so some scientists said, what does that do? And they created some nectar, added the caffeine. I don't know what they crossbred flowers or how they did it, or they just spread the caffeine on there. The bees were something like twice as likely to return to that particular flower.
Oh.
And the bees seemed to be somewhat addicted to caffeine.
Now, I like that.
Okay, I don't know. Pissed off bees, with like they haven't had the caffeine. Maybe if you had like some coffee spray, they're looking happy, just kind of
give them a little spray and get
them
going.
Exactly.
Are they more productive? Are they more energetic? Like,
I think it's like with humans, you think you're more productive, but you're mostly just bouncing off walls.
there's a whole conversation to have around bees just in terms of the colony collapses and the challenges that they're going on. They are another one of the canary in a coal mine kind of things for the damage we're doing to our environment.
It's not just that. Einstein is reputed, I can't find the quote, but Einstein is reputed to have said that if we lose the bees, we've got about 3 years.
Hmm.
Now, I saw a couple of documentaries on it.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, the systemic pesticides that are built into some of our gen mod crops.
Yep.
That the notion is that that's what's killing them.
That's the culprit.
Because apparently there's some European governments and European Union, stuff like that, where they're trying to get away from that. And they're rebuilding the hives to a certain extent.
Hmm.
I do hope that happens.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're going to have to build more drones. But they're like pollinating drones.
Yes. Little ones.
Little, very, very, very tiny ones. Oh, look, there's one outside the window right there.
We are in San Francisco. This is drone country. What do you got?
But this is one I particularly like, and I think you will enjoy. It turns out that there's this one study that talked about what do they call it? Like high alcohol usage adults. Their definition was 8 drinks a week. That's just crazy talk.
What?
That the eight was
where does that put us?
Just barely in that group.
Just
barely.
Maybe.
Although you're drinking metric drinks. So 10 is probably fine for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Little different size. Here's the interesting thing, though. So you may know that the brain, we talked a little bit about this in the diet thing. The brain is an interesting organ in that it can't burn fat the way that the rest of you can. And just to recap for those who didn't hear, like if you're out raking the leaves or something like that, and you have one of those moments like, can't move your hands.
Right.
And your significant other brings you out some cocoa, and 5 minutes later you feel better. It's like, oh, it must have been the cocoa. It wasn't the cocoa. It's your mitochondria in your arms take about 2 minutes to reconfigure the engines. I'm simplifying.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can burn fat. And at that point, most of us have a fairly, we got a big gas tank for that.
Right.
The brain can't do that, though, because if the brain goes offline for 2 minutes, that's the beginning of a bad day at the office.
Yes. Pretty much the end of that day, too.
Well, no. I mean, what your body likes to do is it'll make you pass out.
Right.
And you'll probably, survive.
You'll, depending on how well you land.
There is that. But, the brain pretty much just burns glucose.
Right.
Packages as glycogen. Well, if you're a high alcohol drinker, 8 and up, one of the metabolites that comes out of drinking alcohol, like because your liver takes it and turns it into stuff.
Right.
And that's really the side effect that makes a lot of things important. Do you know that I want to say 2% of the white male population can't get lung cancer? And the reason from smoking.
Right.
And here's why. It's not the nicotine that gets you.
Right.
It is the metabolic side, whatever the liver produces when it's breaking it down, that apparently is the carcinogen.
Oh, okay.
So like, and some people just lack that chromosome. They can't make that work. So in the same way, if anybody drinks alcohol, there is a side chemical created called acetate. Mm-hmm. Heard of acetate?
Okay. Sure.
Well, acetate apparently has a lot of energy in it, but your body doesn't know how to burn it. If you have 8 or more drinks a week, your brain learns to burn it.
Learns to burn acetate.
Amazing, isn't that? So what that means is, you know, most people's brains can only burn sugar.
Yeah.
You know, but you and I,
we're burning alcohol.
If we were on a desert island and all we had was some Chateau Lafite,
we'd be okay.
We could think. We'd be able to think. The rest of it might not work. But you know.
But he also speaks to people like Hemingway, these hard drinking, hard thinking types. You just wonder how much this altered their brain chemistry.
Well, let me ask, if we shouldn't say this where other people can hear it, but it's like, what the heck? Have you ever had a long day? It's conference, it's travel, it's whatever, and you're dead. You're
done.
The neck up. And you're going to meet some friends, going to have a glass of wine. You have the glass of wine, and inside 10 minutes, you feel energized.
You're going again.
Right? Yeah. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Wait a minute. Alcohol is in central nervous system present. What's up with it? I think what happens is that we get a little acetate shot.
Yeah.
And that's what
it charges us up. And invariably, in that scenario, we are telling stories. Like that whole thing fires over.
Precisely. And the thought also is that when real alcoholics are quitting, they refer to a certain fuzziness and inability to think for a while. And the thought is that perhaps it's a lack of acetate. And
so your brain's now hooked on that, too, and is missing it.
So they're actually talking along the lines of some way introducing acetone. It's one of those guys. I'd have to check. I'm doing such a good job reporting this. I'm sure everything that I'm saying is 30% incorrect. But these are things to Google. Or if we're in the Microsoft office, these are things to Bing.
Yes.
And we all recall that Bing is just short for because it's not Google.
Right.
That's right. Anyway, so absolutely great stuff. We don't want to miss. What about you? You got a tech story for me? We can talk about space.
I've actually, you know, over on the .NET Rock side, we've been doing a series of shows around nuclear power, and we spent a whole hour talking about thorium molten salt reactors. So thorium is about 3 times more plentiful than uranium.
Sure.
It's actually more stable than uranium. It doesn't have much in the way of isotopes.
Thorium, though, is one of the 3 elements that when you ingest it into your body, you never get rid of it. So like the idea that Rasputin took enough poison to become resistant to it.
Right.
Yeah, don't do that with arsenic. Because any arsenic that you take,
it's cumulative.
It's arsenic, thorium, and I can't remember the other one. But which is why if you're going to poison somebody with radiation, thorium's the best because you can introduce a little bit at a time.
For
it's
a
never
long
excreted,
time.
And eventually you get a lethal amount.
Yeah. But it is quite common, you know, more common than uranium. It doesn't need to be enriched the same way that uranium needs to be enriched, so a lot less processing. Although, I mean, the big thing that came out of that show was really 3 separate technologies. One is that you can use thorium as a replacement for uranium.
Interesting.
And in fact, they're doing that in Norway right now. They're running a light water reactor on thorium.
Don't you have the waste problem, though? That's my problem with fission, is that we have all this stuff that we have to hope no one touches for 250,000 years.
Well, you do if you don't reprocess it. And in the U.S., you don't reprocess your fuel. You know, it was actually the Carter administration that stopped reprocessing because one of the byproducts of reprocessing fuel is weapons-grade plutonium.
Well, Governor Dixie, somebody or other from Washington State at the time, there had been a reprocessing plant or was going to be one in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And she said they weren't going to do it. And I think that was a big deal. So we
The lashback, in the end, using uranium and light water reactors was about being able to produce weapons-grade nuclears, right? That was what it was all about. And that ended up being the most mature technology that turned into the power system, right?
Sure. Maybe
the origins of light water reactors and molten salt reactors are the same. They both came out of the Oak Ridge Laboratories. It was using the same guys that were designing it. It's just that the one that won was the one that they knew the most about because they were using it to make weaponry.
But it's still all massively crazy because what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise temperature to water to a temperature of 100 degrees Celsius by producing 1,000,000 degrees Celsius.
Well, it's
massively inefficient.
And water's a terrible medium for that. So now you get into the molten salt part of reactors, which is rather than create fuel rods and boil water with it, which is silly because 100 degrees is not hot enough. 100 degrees, we're going to do this in metric. 100 degrees is not hot enough to turn a turbine. You need it to be about 500 degrees. And if you're going to do that, it means you have to pressurize everything, which makes it dangerous.
Very dangerous.
Tricky to deal with. So in a molten salt reactor, whether you run it on uranium or thorium, it doesn't matter. you're using a salt that is naturally liquid at a fairly high temperature. And so it runs at about 800 degrees.
Wow.
Now you can contain it. It's a liquid. It's not boiling or anything. You now pump it around to keep it stable. The cool part about this reactor is if you stop the pumps, it will continue to get hotter. Okay. And eventually get hot to the point where it would boil or create steam or melt its pressure vessel, which is bad. Okay. You don't want any of those things to happen. And pressure vessel is the wrong term because it's not under pressure. You could literally, if you could stand the radiation, you could look in at it. So the way they make, they have a passive safety system for molten salt is that they put a plug at the bottom of the container. Because fission occurs, the reaction occurs based on volume when you talk about salt, not the positioning of the rods and how close they are together, just how much of this radioactive salt do you have. So if you put a...
And when this plug comes out, where does it go?
Underneath the container is three smaller containers connected together by pipes.
Okay.
So you've got a plug that will melt at 1,000 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
The container itself can handle 1,500 degrees. So it's fine. It's not melting at all. But when the plug melts, it drains that molten radioactive into smaller tanks. And those smaller tanks naturally aren't big enough to sustain fission anymore.
Got it. Okay.
So notice a couple of good things that have happened here. One is it requires no power to shut down.
Right.
Right. If it overheats, it shuts itself down. It requires...
It's moving to a lower state of energy at that point. It's where it wants to go.
On its own. And it's not destructive. So at the end of your incident, whatever's caused the problem with the pump stopped working and so forth, you put a new plug in. You heat the three tanks back up enough that the stuff becomes molten because it will solidify.
Sure.
And then you pump it back up into the reaction container and you keep going.
So you haven't made this containment vessel so incredibly radioactive that you got to get rid of it and put it somewhere?
Well,
here's the big question. Would you let one into your town?
Yeah, I mean, I would, but I have a pretty clear understanding of how this works. So part of the problem that we have with the light water reactor design, and you get back to your radioactive waste problem, is that the intent of this design was to make those fuel rods more radioactive. They are more radioactive coming out at the end of the fuel cycle than they are going in, because they're supposed to be reprocessed to pull the plutonium out of them, and then you can turn them into more rods.
And it was all supposed to be temporary until we figured the fusion thing out, which is always going to be 5 years from now.
Yeah. Just like Roslyn, but that's a different thing. But so now you go to places like, well, Germany used to be, they're trying to shut down their nuclear reactors over the Fukushima thing. And the only reason they're able to do that is because they're mostly buying their nuclear power from France now. But France reprocesses their fuel all the time. It's just not that big of a deal. They don't have the fuel storage problem. And back on molten salt, one of the side effects of molten salt, because it's such a flexible fluid, you can keep adding other radioactives to it and you get a net lower radioactive waste out at the end. So you can use it as a radioactive consumer. It will also, when mixed correctly, consume weapons grade radioactives. So if you want to actually dispose
beat those sorts of plowshares,
to actually turn them into electricity. So that's when you start talking about these liquid MOX fuels and so forth. There's good work to be done in there.
Given North Korea and Iran, I don't think my country's going to be breaking down too many nukes for a while.
Well, you've got more than enough.
I've heard that. But you know there's always more.
There's always more. But so that's been the fun. There's another part to this, but we'll leave it for another time, which was next generation turbines as well. So really it was the three pieces in talking about taking nuclear technology to a new level, which was using thorium instead of uranium, molten salt instead of rod-based, and much more advanced turbines.
Cool.
We're basically spinning the same turbines we've been spinning since the late 1800s.
So you're a build a lot of nukes and turn them into hydrogen kind of guy.
I'm a big believer in solving our problems intelligently with better solutions. Like the big thing for me, more than anything, is you've got these sites already. You already run nuclear power plants that are getting old. They already have turbines. They already have all the electrical wiring going to them, and you already have piles of fuel there. You put a molten salt reactor on that site, you can start using up what you're currently calling waste and making it into electricity and making it less dangerous over time.
So you're saying that in the thorium salts, you can add the uranium waste?
Yes.
Doesn't that reintroduce the problem that we had the way...
Well, remember this, in the end, nuclear reactors are about transmutation. You're turning atoms into other atoms.
Right.
So eventually you're going to... one of the interesting byproducts, by the way, of using thorium, cannot make weapons from it. It doesn't have that effect.
Nice.
So it's another good reason to switch to thorium is that it just doesn't... It stops nuclear proliferation because its byproducts are impossible to use in nuclear weapons.
No, it's a great idea because, you know, I hear people talk about hydrogen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what they don't really understand that hydrogen is just electricity in a bottle. And so, you know, the point of hydrogen is that you can fuel a car with it.
It's about transporting power.
Precisely. I'm saying this is the way you put electricity in a bottle. So what we need is we need to cover North Dakota with nuclear reactors and then take all that stuff. And we can't transmit the electricity over long distances without transmission losses. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of concerns and the eyesore thing. And I can't have a big cable in the back of my car. And so the notion is, what can we do with electricity? We can take water and we can bust it into hydrogen and oxygen. And so we need electricity for that. So really, a hydrogen car is just another form of an electric car.
Yep.
Not everybody gets that.
It's just a different kind of battery.
Precisely. But the problem with the whole hydrogen idea is what we're really saying is, I still think we should burn a lot of coal, but in somebody else's state.
Yeah.
and then ship the hydrogen into my state.
Well, where we generate the power is also important in how we generate it. And it's certainly, you know, New Mexico can generate an awful lot of electricity out of solar power. They just don't need near as much of it, and it's hard to transport. Again, better transportation solutions. I don't think the fuel cell is going to be the way, though, speaking of other sciences. The best new technology I've seen so far, and this will be in a nanotech show we've got coming up soon, is graphene.
That's, you know, the articles about graphene have been fantastic. I mean, forget everything else. The fact that you have a, if this connects, they say Boeing, was it that Lockheed makes it or Boeing? Someone makes it at this point, some kind of graphene. And it's basically one of these one molecule kinds of sheets of stuff.
Yep.
It's a carbon atom. And the most interesting thing that I've seen is that the holes in it are so small that you can pour salt water through it and the water molecules make it through and the salt molecules don't.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. Hang on. If we can do that, we're stopping the bacteria. Mm-hmm. We're stopping the viruses. We're stopping a tremendous amount of the pathogens.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, can you imagine if anywhere you could just take a pile of salt water and make it drinkable?
Yeah.
Having said that, I do wonder how you clean those.
At some point, the salt will plug everything up.
I think the first run.
That's part of the process. So it turns out if you take graphene and you stack it in multiple layers and a few other tricks, you can make it into an ultracapacitor.
Yeah, an awesome battery, apparently. Yeah.
And that one that charges extremely fast and can discharge extremely fast too, or slowly as you wish.
Right.
So the power density on it is running close to 10 times what lithium ion batteries would do.
Essentially very high. I've also read that very high conductivity. I mean, we're almost talking superconductor.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting how many different things carbon can do?
Well, if you look at the level of commonality of particular atoms, I think carbon's the third, fourth.
It's right up there.
Most, you know, so what is it? It's hydrogen, helium. I think it's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. So anyway, that's something. But you tend to think of carbon in fairly stable forms, but in actual fact, it isn't. And once we have carbon down that controlled, we can make diamonds anytime we feel like it.
Yeah.
Their value will go to nothing.
Well,
Their value has always been nothing.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's always been extremely well-engineered marketing. You know? Yeah, you can't – don't bother trying to talk your girlfriend out of it, but the whole point is all diamonds are blood diamonds.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, all of these devices are constructs to buy things, right? Whether you want to – the modern concept of Thanksgiving and the modern concept of Christmas. I mean, these are constructs created by retail outlets. Because it's good for business. And the De Beers conglomerate that's really created the diamond business over the past few hundred years, that's their construct. It was their idea that you give out diamonds for weddings.
They're in some trouble. I'm told that the Kimberly mines are just about played out.
Yeah.
That'll make for an interesting story.
Yeah, things will change around that.
When that actually happens. And graphene apparently is one of those things that makes it easier to build lighter kinds of vehicles. Like if you've been following these space guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty amazing. Although, honestly, I love what the Virgin Galactic guys are trying to do.
Did their first above supersonic flight of Spaceship 2.
Yes, indeed. With kind of sort of fuel. You know, they didn't have like the real fuel. They were doing the contrails with it.
Right.
But, I don't know. 63 miles. 100 kilometers.
Yeah,
would you pay $200,000?
It's a lot for a three-minute trip.
You know, what's the difference between that and an airliner? You see the curvature of the Earth. You know, the Concorde used to do the curvature of the Earth, and it wasn't that much.
And I think you can do a Vomit Comet ride for $7,000 now.
Is it $7,000?
Yeah.
No, I think it's less than that.
Is it less than that?
Yeah, I mean, because in Vegas, they've got them, and my understanding was that they were more in the grand-ish range or something
like
that.
So if you really want to have zero-G for just a few seconds, but you can do it. You don't have to spend that much money.
It's true. No, it's absolutely true. No, and the interesting thing is they kind of go up. They sort of like touch 62 miles, 64 miles, whatever. And sort of come back. They're not there very long.
They're not going very fast.
But it's nice that there's a start. And I think it's pretty cool that the whole Dragon robot supply ship has been
SpaceX
been working. Yeah. That's quite surprising.
And they've building, starting to build the 7-seat manned version of it. And the Merlin D is coming for the version 1.1 of the Falcon 9.
Well, who were the guys who did a landing on the tail thing where they took off and then they did the Wernher von Braun 1950s spaceship with fins landing on its butt on the tail?
Now, SpaceX has a rocket called Grasshopper where they're doing that.
Yes, it's Grasshopper. That's right. Yeah.
But before that, I mean, the Douglas company did the DCX.
Right.
And then one of the legs failed and it tipped over. And
that was kind of, yeah.
It was sad. It's a very sad video watching that rocket burn itself up.
Well, it certainly would be impressive to the Wernher von Braun, you know, from the Earth to the Moon kind
sure.
of thing. But
I had an opportunity to tour SpaceX during the road trip last year.
Nice.
And so got a chance to talk to the engineers. And of course, Elon Musk's plan all along was that everything would be reusable.
We're eventually
that
the
rockets would fly back. I mean, Elon's on record saying, I plan to retire on Mars, which I think is a hell of a good statement.
It is.
But, talking to our tour guide was one of the structural engineers, and I was saying, like, okay, you're not returning these rockets. Like, they are still disposable rockets. Granted, you've literally cut the price of rocketry in half.
Right.
So good on you. But what about the return things? And he was pretty straight up. He just said, you know what? It is pretty hard to turn a rocket around and still have it in one piece when you finish the turn.
That's what I've never understood about the whole plan. I mean, you got it up there pretty high in the first place, and if it weren't hard to get it up that high, then we'd be doing that a lot.
And I went, you know, now let me conjoin those two things. So you got Bert Rutan over with
is Bert still alive?
Bert is working with Richard Branson on the whole Spaceship Two, Virgin Galactic.
You know, that makes sense because it certainly has a Bert Rutan sort
absolutely.
Of look to it.
Well, the White Knight is clearly him, right? So he's put together a proposal to build a White Knight-like aircraft capable of carrying one of Elon Musk's rockets up to 80,000 feet, drop it, and fire
right.
it.
Right.
But in order to build it, but this time White Knight is two 747s mounted together. So take two 747 fuselages, share a wing, three engines on the outboard side of either way, and then hang a Falcon sized rocket in between the two and fire it from there.
Why we don't just put the beanstalk up just once and for all?
Well, now you're going to talk about carbon again.
I know.
It looks
like
there's a carbon structure strong enough to pull that off.
It would be astounding.
Yeah.
It'd be absolutely astounding.
So, it would be a heck of a thing. I think we're getting closer to that being doable.
Well, along those lines, did you send in your $38 to go to Mars?
I have not. Have you?
I have not. I might just send in the $38, not with the intention of going. But did you see, I've forgotten the name of the organization, but they're going to send people to Mars one way.
Yep.
And they're going to launch in 10 years.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is they're going to make, it's going to be easier because they're going to sort of send them there and strand them.
Yes.
Which...
Now that, survive.
That could be some very, very... Yeah, and I wonder how they reckon that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because along those lines, the latest rover that we sent...
Curiosity.
Curiosity. Have you looked at the pictures of him? It's the first time that it looks like me with my SLR.
Yep.
Is taking a picture. There's a crispness.
It's HD Mars.
It no longer feels like webcam Mars, you know? I mean, let's be clear. My hat is off to all of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
That Rube Goldberg scheme to land the thing.
Yes.
I was like, oh, this is going to be another one of those things where we spend a lot of money. It doesn't work.
Nothing happens. Yeah.
And American taxpayers don't want any more space stuff. Cause Lord, you know, cause we do cost them 0.3% for the space stuff.
Yes.
You know, I mean, realize there's lots of other places that we could be throwing money away, but
yeah. Well, and Sky Crane is the only system ever developed that can land a ton softly, precisely.
God.
And they're going to keep using it.
It's like something out of science fiction.
It
absolutely was.
And I think they can scale it up as high as 5 tons.
When they sent, Sojourner and Spirit?
Yep.
Who were the two? That was pretty amazing when they wrapped them in a beach ball.
Oh, Sojourner was the original, the little guy.
There were two little guys at the same time. Spirit
and Discovery.
Opportunity?
The Spirit and Opportunity. Are the bigger guys. They're the sort of golf cart sized ones.
Right. But like, they're still running.
Yeah, there's well, one of them is.
They're
a little over past their warranty period.
It's quite a bit past their warranty. But I mean, the idea that they did that and it just worked the first time. You think about all the projects that we do.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. Almost nothing I do works the first time. I mean, almost nothing, potentially nothing, you know, at all. And it's just such a long way to, you know.
Yeah, very. Yeah, we could talk about all the disasters as well. And we did a whole show on the .NET Rock side, one of the geek outs on Mars. And I talked about how Mars, Observer was the mission.
That's the problem. Mars's metric, but it was an American ship. That was a problem.
Yeah. Well, that was a climate orbiter. There's a bunch of failures there.
Yeah.
Well, look.
Are we out of that time again?
Yeah, we are at that time. Gosh, you know, and as usual.
I had a new server interpretation. I'll have to come back and we'll do it again.
We'll do another show.
It is always a pleasure and an honor to speak with you, sir. And to our listeners, thanks for putting up with us for another half an hour.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.